General Ann Dunwoody, U.S. Army retired, is author of the new book, A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General, co-authoring with Tomago Collins. General Dunwoody, thank you very much for your time today. We gain insight into your thoughts and theories about leadership from looking just at the book flap on the inside. The qualities that you write about in this book you write became instilled in me through relationships with my husband, family, friends, coaches, and soldiers. You take influences, it sounds like, from wherever you went in life. Thank you very much for your time today, General.
Thank you. It is great to be here with you, Francis. Well, I think what I would say is that I believe good leaders never stop learning, even at the ripe old age where we are now, but throughout our life, from our family, our moms, dads, brothers, and sisters, you're always learning. And I was blessed to come from a values-based family, taught me right from wrong, and I had the old hot fanny growing up, so I learned some real good lessons. And then from your friends. And even as I joined the military, what I realized is you learn from good leaders and bad leaders, and you take away those kind of traits that you think were effective, that helped you train, teach people with dignity and respect. And you see behaviors that don't value the individual or humiliate the individual, and those are the kind of things you learn and say, I hope I never do that. And so your repertoire is things that you see in people, role models that you take and put in your rucksack, and then those things that you hope you never demonstrate because you don't think they're the kind of leadership traits that are effective.
General Dunwoody, what attracted you to want to go into the military in the first place, and do you believe that those elements are still in place today that will attract future four-star generals, females, to the military?
Well, it's funny, Francis. I really never thought I was going to join the military, even with four generations of West Pointers in my family. My brother, my dad, my grandfather, my great-grandfather were all West Pointers. And I never dreamed of coming to the military. I always wanted to be a phys ed teacher and a coach. I was a tomboy. I loved sports. I'd rather be outdoors, play tennis in college, went to one of the best and gymnastics phys ed schools in the country in upstate New York. And during my junior year in college, the Army, it was post-Vietnam, was trying to attract more women. And they had a program that if you were accepted, they paid you $500 a month during your senior year in college. You got a commission as a second lieutenant, and you only had a two-year commitment. And I thought, $500 was a lot of money back then, 1975. And I thought I could stand on my head for 2 years. So I really saw my going in the Army just a detour, two-year detour en route to my teaching and coaching profession. And what I found when I got in the military is that I loved being a soldier and I loved leading soldiers. And I remember telling my dad, you know, I'm going to keep doing this as long as I enjoy it and I can make a difference. I'm allowed to make a difference. And what I witnessed throughout my career was the doors continued to open. And so what I tell young folks today is that it's been a wonderful journey where, not without challenges, but every career has challenges, and but lots of opportunities. And what I witnessed was an Army and military that gave me these huge opportunities I probably wouldn't have had any other profession, but allowed me opportunities and experiences that made me a better person and a better leader.
I greatly enjoyed that each of the chapters in your book focuses on one of the key leadership elements that you taught and tried to follow throughout your career, and we'll talk about those in turn. But I wonder, what was the same and what was different about leading your first command, which was about 100 soldiers, you write, and your final command, which was U.S. Army Materiel Command, a huge $60 billion enterprise?
Well, obviously the responsibility of a platoon, leading a platoon and leading a major Army command, just at size and scope and responsibility, the difference is probably overwhelming. But the principles are much the same, although at the platoon leader, you're more a tactical leader, and at the Army Materiel Command, you're more focused on strategic issues. But teaching people, training people, treating people with dignity and respect, rewarding people for good performance, disciplining those who don't meet the standard. Those are principles that I think exist throughout and help me be a better leader.
The first chapter in your book is called Walk the Walk, and the leadership standard included is live to a higher standard. You write in this chapter about the family legacy that you continued, as you alluded to a moment ago. What's the concept of live to a higher standard mean, though, not just to you, but you believe to all of your colleagues in the Army?
Well, I think most people don't realize that only 1% of the American population will ever serve in the military. And so many people don't know that in this profession that we are held to a higher standard. We take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. We're subject to Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is a code of conduct, if you will, that governs your behavior on and off duty, in and out of uniform. And then finally, in the military, as you would suspect, we have standards for everything. How you wear your hair, how you wear your uniform, how many push-ups you can do, how fast you can run. And what I assumed when I came in the military as a woman back in 1975 is that I would have to exceed those standards in order to be have credibility, to fit in, and to have to be recognized and have a good reputation. But what I realized is that all the good leaders I served with held themselves to a higher standard. In the book, I liken it to like being a C student and an A student. If you meet the standard, you're a C student. If you exceed the standards, you're an A student. And what you want is an organization that you inspire, encourage people who meet the standards to want to exceed the standard, and the good leaders that I served with did just that.
The second chapter is titled, Wendell Would Be Proud. Who was Wendell Bowen, and what influence did he have on you, and what did he teach you that you talk about in this book?
Wendell Bowen was my very first platoon sergeant, Sergeant First Class Wendell Bowen from Tennessee. And when I had my first platoon, he brought me in not as a female platoon leader, but as a platoon leader, and he told me he wanted to make me the best platoon leader in the Army. Now, he'd been to Vietnam, and back then we were kind of a broken, hollow Army, but there was nothing broken or hollow about Sergeant Bowen. He taught me what right looked like. He taught me how to be a good second lieutenant, and he showed this butter bar that you should never walk by a mistake, and that's probably one of the most valuable lessons I ever learned. And when I talk about not walking by a mistake, it's when you see something that's not the standard, that's not correct, that you have to make that on-the-spot correction, or you just set a new lower standard. And if you saw a soldier not wearing headgear when they're supposed to and you walk by, they think it's okay not to wear your headgear. And it's a slippery slope. All of a sudden, they're not cleaning their weapons and maintaining them and training, so when they get in combat, it's that slippery slope. They have a malfunction. They could get hurt and could cause fatalities. So maintaining those standards and being a self-policing organization, because when you make on-the-spot corrections, when you correct people, other people feel okay to correct. And by that, you police the force to the standards.
That's one of four concepts that you write about Sergeant Bowen teaching you. Two of them appeared to me to be fairly self-evident: be true to yourself, and the other is he showed me what right looks like. The first one that you wrote about, though, I thought was particularly noteworthy. He never once gave me advice on being a female soldier. Why is that noteworthy, General Dunwoody?
Well, you know, when you come in and you're the only female among the ranks, you think people might tend to treat you with kid gloves, you know, as a woman, you can't lift the toolbox, you can't. But he never did. He treated me like a soldier, he treated me like an officer, and he showed me what right looked like. And he never said there was something I couldn't do just because I happened to be a female. He saw me as a soldier, not as a female soldier, and I appreciated that. And when I grew through the ranks, I'd look out at my platoon and I saw soldiers. I didn't see women, I didn't see men, I didn't see black, I didn't see white, I saw professionals.
The third chapter of your book, The Enemy Within, and the takeaway from this is leaders aren't invincible, don't try to be. The people under your command see through you when you try to, I imagine, General.
Well, they do, but the I think the real takeaway lesson for me, especially in the military, is we're trained to be macho, to be tough, to suck it up. And you want your soldiers to believe they can do anything, and they would do anything for you if you say, no, you're going to take care of them. But we're also human beings. And sometimes things build up, and they're more than we're capable. And I've had an experience myself, and I've seen it in others, where we try to suck it up to the detriment of our own health. That maybe it's not just a bad day at the office, but maybe you also have marital problems and financial problems. And so for that one person, that one soldier, it becomes overwhelming. And that's why I say we're not invincible, and you have to recognize that we can only do so much, and then we need to either share or consult or get help. And that's okay.
Has that been a culture change?
I wouldn't call it a culture change. I just would call it, in my book, just a leadership principle that I found and I saw in others. And I think it is hard. It's probably one of the most difficult ones because we don't like to admit we have vulnerabilities. We don't like to admit we have weaknesses. But if we don't acknowledge those vulnerabilities and weaknesses, you can't get better.
The concept, believe in yourself, is what you articulate in the fourth chapter. Why'd you title this chapter Door Kickers?
You know, with almost 40 years in the military, I witnessed, you know, part of the finishing and the integration of blacks into the military, women into the military, then gays into the military, now women in combat is being pursued. So I've seen these evolutions, these transformations, and they don't happen by accident. They don't happen overnight. They happen because people believe. They believe in you, and you believe in yourself, and you believe you're capable. And it doesn't matter which walk of life you come from, but you might have to kick down some doors. Some of them are going to be open for you, and some of them you're to barrel through. But to do that, if you believe that you're capable and you believe that you can do it, then believe it and do it.
You write in this chapter, ma'am, about attending the Army Four-Star Conference. What's the impression, the takeaway from that, and why was it something that was significant in your career?
Well, there's a debate going on, and it's still going on, about women in combat and whether they're capable or not. And I guess during this discussion, one of the retired four-stars mentioned that every time we let women into something, we lower the standards, whether it's when they came in the military, PT standards went down, when we brought them to airborne, the airborne went down, blah. And I just sat and listened. And I reflecting back on my own career, you know, the women don't set the standards, the military does. And yes, there were two different standards for men and women for physical training, but it wasn't the women that did that. It didn't mean the women couldn't do more. And then I thought about going to airborne school when they first allowed women to go to airborne school. We weren't greeted with open arms. It was like, what are you doing? What are we going to do with women jumping out of airplanes? And there were subtleties that tried to discourage you from going and from completing. But also the black hats, you know, they yelled at everybody, men, women. That's instructors down there. But I had to share, if I had not been given that opportunity to go to airborne school, I would never have been able to command an airborne company in Germany. I would never have ended up commanding a battalion in the 82nd Airborne Division. And I probably wouldn't have been sitting at that four-star table, I guess. So I see the opportunity to do that opened the door for so many other opportunities, and I think the same is true today.
Chapter 5, Courage. Do the right thing for the right reason. It may seem self-evident, but obviously it isn't, because you wanted to devote a chapter to it. What do people misunderstand, do you think, about the concept of doing the right thing for the right reason?
Well, I think sometimes people think that they're doing the thing because that's what everyone wants them to do, and it might not be the right thing to do. Or they think they're doing it because it's a politically correct thing to do, or they won't get anyone mad at them because they choose to do something else, whether they believed in it or not. And I'm not saying that's common. I just know that when you make those really hard, tough calls, and because you know it's for the right reason, that they are tough calls.
Recognize your advocates, Janus faces, and detractors. I love allusions to mythology, ma'am. Janice faces obviously are two-faced. What's your experience there?
The real leadership lesson is you think that everyone's genuine, you want to believe that everyone's got your best interests at heart. But the reality is what I experienced is, and I put them in those three categories, the leaders that I work with or people were either advocates, and they're people that supported you, and either knowingly or unknowingly, they were your advocate in all circles. There were two-faced people, Janice facers, that to your face, they're saying, oh, yeah, what a wonderful, and then behind your back, they're stabbing you and, you know, running you down or not necessarily looking after your best interest. And then the last group, the detractors, are people that don't like you. Maybe they don't think women belong in the military, and maybe this is a man's world, and what are you doing in here? Nothing you're going to do is going to change that. But the leadership lesson is no matter who, no matter what kind of leader you're working with or for, is that you stay on the moral high ground. Do not stoop to name-calling and innuendos or, you know, lowering your own standards, which is very tempting at times because it gets frustrating when people don't treat you like you think you should be. But what I found, if you stay on the moral high ground, don't lower your standards, many times you can convert these people because they see that you're professional, that you're capable.
The book is A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General. General Ann Dunwoody, U.S. Army, retired, is the author. And maybe the understatement of the book on page 129 in this chapter, ma'am, not everyone I served with was a Dunwoody advocate. You've told some stories, but you crystallize it quite well there. You mentioned a moment ago winning people over just by doing your job and doing it to the highest standard. Is it as simple as that, or are there strategies involved within that, ma'am?
It sounds simple, but it's nothing is ever simple. Walking by a mistake is not simple, and I say that because if you think about GM, General Motors, if someone had identified that defective ignition instead of trying to cover it up, how many billions they could have saved in lawsuits and you know, media or lives they might have saved. But so all these lessons, they always brief well, but boy, they really are hard, and this is no different. And I say staying on the moral high ground and not lowering your standards, the biggest thing too from that is if you have a yeller and a screamer or a guy that or gal that's leader that's not, you got to protect your subordinates from that behavior. And that's hard too, because you they're good soldiers, and when they see that kind of behavior or they become a recipient of the yelling and screaming, all you do is discourage them from wanting to continue in the profession. So there's a lot to not lowering your standards and staying on moral high ground, but also exposing your folks to the good leaders and protecting them from the bad.
Earlier in our conversation, ma'am, you talked about some of the transitions that you saw and experienced in your years in the Army. And you write about leveraging the power of diversity in Chapter 7 of this book, and you call it the mirror-mirror syndrome. What do you mean by the mirror-mirror syndrome, ma'am?
And, Francis, I should have told you, please call me Ann. But the mirror-mirror syndrome is we have the tendency to, you know, promote in our own image. And so I have people surround people that think like me, that look like me, educated like me. And what I've found in the military, especially, can you imagine when this was this started the integration of women into the regular Army, that it was pretty much a man's world. And so there were a lot of look-likes, act-likes, and think-likes in certain organizations and in certain decision-making forums. But what I found with the complex problems that we have, that you really, if you want to leverage the talent in your organization, you'll get the best and the brightest from all walks of life and make sure they're sitting at that table, because they're going to look at that problem different than you're going to look at it. And they're going to offer perspectives that are different from the perspectives. And so by listening to perspectives from all points of view, I found it'll come up with a better solution.
You write in this chapter about your experience meeting the three kings, the most prestigious jobs commanding the core war fighting headquarters like the 18th Airborne Corps, but arguably the most powerful and influential of the three stars are the three kings. Who were they, and what did you note as you met them for the first time in the Pentagon?
The three kings were three-star generals who were a select group, mostly doing with operations, the G3, finances, the G8, and the Army Budget Office, who, again, with the financials and strategy. And this group was used in a good way, and intentions were good, to help the chief of staff and the vice chief of staff of the military prioritize limited resources. So it really was set up to help manage the shortages, because you never have all the money. Where are you going to buy? What are you going to buy? And so they were very, very powerful. With the he who controls the purse strings controls a lot of things.
Yes.
So, but these three, all male, all combat arms, all West Pointers, I think my perception was they thought alike, and so their solutions and recommendations didn't encompass a broader solution set, if you will, because they had a very, not that they weren't all smart and intelligent and bright, but they didn't have other perspectives in that decision-making forum to perhaps give different, that might have resulted in different recommendations.
And what's the result of that changing, or how is that manifesting itself toward the end of your career and today, do you believe, ma'am?
I think what's, having talked to the chief of staff about it, I think what's happened is it has opened up their aperture. And so before making major decisions, they've become more inclusive of people, other stakeholders, either at service support or combat service support or different aspects. People have a vested interest in that decision before the decision is made.
You write in the next chapter, Call Me Coach is the title of this one, and the leadership principle here is form your winning team. And I'm struck by the sports analogy that you use here, and you spoke earlier about your interest in sports. Why is that such a good analogy for developing a winning team, not just in the military, but these lessons are applicable in the private sector as well?
Well, I believe the winning team equates to a high-performing organization. And so if you build your winning team by identifying the talent and getting the right people in the right positions and rewarding that behavior that supports the future, not those that are resistant to change, that you can get a team that wants to be all A+. They want to exceed the standards. They want to be high-performing. No one wants to be part of a low-performing organization. They all want to be part of a high-performing organization. And if you build that winning team from the top and make sure that you've got the best and brightest and that those are developing the next bench of best and brightest, it's a continuous cycle that you're going to get people that want to be part of your organization. They're proud to wear your patch or your pin. They're proud to be branded by your organization because your reputation of the organization with a winning team that becomes high performing becomes national and then global.
The coaching analogy extends to the chapter on developing your strategic vision. You write, my most extensive coaching job came when I oversaw the Army Materiel Command, and we talked about that being a $60 billion enterprise earlier in our conversation, ma'am. But I'm struck by the Wizard of Oz analogies that are all throughout this book, and this chapter is titled The Power of the Yellow Brick Road.
One of my favorite movies, obviously, and because again, it went from being a, kind of a fun fairy tale to a lesson with a lot of leadership lessons in it that stayed with me for life. But one of the probably important lessons I learned, even as a four-star, came from a retired chief of staff who suggested with this huge organization that my vision be portrayed in a one slide instead of just a script. And what he said was, if you can do that, and he showed me what he used as a chief, very simple back then, much more complex these days, that if you can build a vision that every person in your organization can see themselves in that vision and know how important he or she is to the accomplishment of that mission and that vision, no matter where they are, whether they're a mechanic down in the depot or a general manager someplace or a platoon leader, if they can see that their role is important, and that's what I try to do is if I could get all 69,000 people coming to work every day saying, I know that what I do counts and matters, and if I don't, there's going to be a shortfall. And when you get that kind of synergy, that's the power of a good vision, that people know where they're going, they know how important they are to the accomplishment of it, and it's really exciting.
The Yellow Brick Road slides on page 185 of this book, and I commend it to folks who pick it up and make sure that you peruse that slide and understand it. You have another slide here, the bullet train slide. What's the connection between the two, ma'am?
The first one, the Yellow Brick Road slide, was the very first one for the when I just took over as a four-star. And during my 4 years in command, we were supporting war on two fronts, but we also had to move our headquarters from Fort Belvoir to Huntsville, Alabama, as a result of the Base Realignment Commission. And so the Yellow Brick Road vision kind of took us to Huntsville, how we were going to get there, what we had to do while we were moving. And then once we got there, we kind of, where are we going? And so the bullet train was kind of the next vision that, gosh, we are clicking on all cylinders. We're no longer skipping down the Yellow Brick Road. We are zooming into the future with a leveraging of technology by the consolidation, the optimization of capabilities. And so that was our new vision. And that one helped us encourage people to want to leave the D.C. area, Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and come to Huntsville, Alabama. And originally, we didn't have a whole lot of folks that were excited about that, but they became excited about what the command was going to do, and they wanted to be part of it.
The next chapter is titled Know When to Fold Them, the leadership principle involved there. And you tell an interesting anecdote to start this story about going to Yankee Stadium, not a place that I would expect necessarily to find a four-star general.
I had the honor and privilege of throwing out the first pitch for the Yankees game at Military Appreciation Day. And when they asked me to do that, I didn't think anything of it. Sure, I played softball growing up. I'm a phys ed teacher and all that kind of stuff. I thought, but as it got closer, people started inquiring, my fellow four stars, you know, you're not going to throw like a girl, are you? You're going to throw from the mound, aren't you? You're not going to step halfway. You're not going to hit the dirt. And I'm like, God, I never thought about all these things. And so I started getting a little nervous, but my husband, he bought a baseball. I had my glove, and he measured off 60 feet, 6 inches in the backyard and made me throw 10 pitches every night when I got home from work and make sure I get it to the plate. And it was the most, Francis, the most nervous I've ever been, because when you walk out, we're playing the Mets, and they got the Jumbotron, and you're on uniform walking out there, and people are yelling and screaming. The noise is just so overwhelming. And you're like, oh, my gosh. And A.J. Burnett was on the mound because he's not Mr. Friendly. So he just wanted to get on, get your pitch out of the way, and
right.
Let me get to my But, you know, we had fun with the catcher by turning down a couple of his signals and then finally threw a real good pitch in there. And my husband, I think, was more relieved than I was.
What did that signify, though, about knowing when to fold them?
When I was coming, the whole know when to fold them was, went back to Derek Jeter when he decided to retire and announced it a year early, and still capable, still on a high mark, if you will. But he just knew that was time, and I respected that. You know, sometimes we don't know what else we're going to do, and we continue doing it because we don't know what else. And it might be time, but it's not an age thing, and it's not a 10-year thing. It's as you know. And as I was going through after almost 40 years, I felt like I was in a really wonderful place in the military. I commanded at the highest levels. I loved what I did. I looked at the bench that we had developed, and I saw these young horses out there that were ready to go. And so I knew for me, my dad was getting older and not in good health. I had grandchildren I hadn't seen. I started having my own health issue, broken ankle, climbing a mountain, and, you know, smattered wrist, running in the dark, and things like that. I thought, gosh, I hope I'm healthy enough. And so I think it's okay that you retire on your own terms, and not too often it's another forcing function. You didn't get promoted, you didn't get command, and that's always a little harder because it's a negative way of departing instead of, you know, I think I'm ready, and or not. I think I can still contribute, and you choose to do so. So it's very personal, but I think a lot of times it can be by default. And the point here, I left feeling so good, and I know people who have done that.
And you and other leaders tell me on an ongoing basis that they're comfortable to leave on their own terms because they do what you write about in the last chapter of this book, and that's building your bench. You're comfortable with the succession that's in place to continue the enterprise after you're no longer there.
That's exactly right. You know, and I think the worst thing, I think I mentioned this in the book, is when they ask who's going to replace you and you don't have an answer, then it's a shame on you. Because you should have several folks that could step up and fill your shoes and continue. And if you don't have that succession plan, if you don't have a smooth transition, the only people that suffer are the men and women in the unit. Because then it's disruptive, start all over, there's gaps, there's skips. And so the succession planning and the timing and the transition allows for a nice exit and a smooth entrance for the new team.
Some observations in the afterthoughts of your book that I really, really enjoyed. So they're very pointed. But the most important one, I think, is you write, the U.S. Army shattered the brass ceiling, not Ann Dunwoody. Why is that noteworthy in your mind, ma'am?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of firsts in my life, as have many women who came in the same time I did. And people go, oh, you're the one. You shattered the brass ceiling. You broke the glass ceiling. But the reality is there was a whole cohort of women before me. There's a whole cohort of women with me. And there's also a whole cohort of men and throughout the Army and throughout my military career that selected, promoted, and recommended me based on my own capabilities. And I would have never, if I thought I was being selected because I was a woman, I would have turned it down in a heartbeat. If I thought I was selected for, I believe everything I was selected for was because the best qualified. And because of that, the Army, I believe, gets the credit for the coaching, the mentoring, professional development, the assignments that I had, and the ultimate promotion to four-star general is credited to them.
The book is called A Higher Standard, Leadership Strategies from America's First Female Four-Star General, General Ann Dunwoody, U.S. Army Retired, with Tomago Collins. Ma'am, congratulations on the book, and thank you very much for your time today. It's been delightful.
Thank you, Francis. I enjoyed it a lot.